Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Yes, and it's actually our second Ask Anything segment, both for tonight and for our resident human condition guru clinical psychologist, Lynn Worsley. Last week, Lynn put herself up for any and every question about the human condition. There was a huge response. So for the next 2 weeks leading up to the end of the Open House year and my time on the program, you can now know, it'll be Ask Anything of Lynn. You can tap into the vast storehouse of Worsley wisdom by giving us a call on 1300 40 2020 or post on our Open House Community Facebook page. Lynn, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Great to see you. And I'm sure there are so many questions from our listeners, having heard your Worsley wisdom over these last nearly 3 years
nearly
now.
Nearly 3 years,
yeah,
yes.
Wow, how time's flown.
It has.
So first question, Wendy's friend cannot stand positive people and cannot stand negative people. She's in a difficult position to cope with. What's her problem? What's the solution for her?
She sounds very confused.
Yes.
without very much information there, but I've been thinking about this one for a little while because I was thinking if someone is having a difficulty not coping with positive people,
they can be a bit nauseating sometimes.
Yes, and there's a difference between positive and negative. And I think this is where, you know, if we look back on the series that we did on optimism,
yes,
that optimistic people aren't necessarily positive people. Optimistic people look at negative situations in a certain way and positive situations in a certain way.
Yeah.
So someone who is really a nauseatingly positive is someone who will just say everything is good or optimize a situation when it really needs to be knuckled down and looked at in a, you know, looking at the bare facts and working out what's really happening.
And being honest sometimes.
And being honest.
It's a matter of that.
That's right. But then optimistic person will actually look at a situation and see how they can make a change to it or how they may have contributed to the problem in the first place and what they might be able to change about that. So Wendy's friend who can't manage positive people may be having a difficulty with someone who's very flowery about their positivity. Or alternatively, she may herself be very pessimistic and may not like anyone having some good things going on around her.
Yes.
And so this could go to another much deeper issue. If she's saying she can't stand positive people and she also can't stand negative people, she could have what we call a martyr complex.
Tell me more.
And the martyr complex is when somebody is so, they see their sense of self about always being in the worst situation. So if someone's better than them, then they're trying to cheer them up. Or someone's being positive around them, trying to cheer them up. Well, they don't want to be cheered up because they're the martyr. Everything's going wrong and everything's really bad. And so they really need to maintain that status.
Yeah.
But if someone's really negative and really down, that would mean that they're going to displace their status. So, you know, if they're on the bottom of the ladder and with all the worst things that are going on and somebody else is worse off than them, then that actually displaces them. So we have the martyr who's not able to be the martyr anymore. They have to look after the negative person. So that person, you know, Wendy's friend could have that issue where she's really just likes to be in that situation where she's, you know, always feeling at the worst and everyone knows that.
Yes.
Or she could also have a very pessimistic style of thinking herself.
Okay. Wendy, I hope that's helped you a bit. If you'd like to join the conversation, you'd like to throw up any and all questions to Lynn Worsley, our human condition guru, the number is 1-300-40-2020. Give us a ring now. Leading on from that, can I ask you to kind of summarise the whole positive psychology movement, what it means, and before the advent of positive psychology, how would you describe the general approach to psychology?
Okay, before we had, you know, positive psychology, which has been emerging, you know, I'd like to say it's sort of snowballing, and I think at the moment we're about to hit a big thunderstorm, and I mean snow avalanche, because we're getting so much positivity. But really, before the positive psychology movement, we had very much like the problem saturated environment where psychology was spending most of the time looking at a phenomena that was going wrong.
Yes.
And looking at the phenomena that was interesting to people, which was the the disorders and the poor behaviours and the things that are going wrong with people and the risks. So, you know, a lot of psychology, and when I first entered the profession, I found it quite irritating, to be honest, because we spend a lot of time analysing the risks and the problems, and, you know, that'd be the end of the lecture. And you'd go, well, what are you going to do with it? You know, how are you going to change this?
Actually, they'd just leave it hanging up in the air.
They'd just leave it hanging in the air, and you'd feel like, you know, what can you do with this? Whereas I'd come from education and nursing where, you know, and working with young children where you really looked at where the child was at and what was the next stage of development and how you're going to enhance that.
Yeah.
But the emerging part of psychology, positive psychology, was where people started to say, you know, what works? You know, how do we get what works? And a couple called Steve DeShazer and Insu Kimberg started the solution-focused movement.
Yeah.
And they had, you know, gurus sitting around the table analysing, you know, what were the exceptions to the problem and what were the solutions that were possibly in place if the problem didn't exist.
And it really has had a very, very big impact on psychology.
Very big impact on lots of people's lives. Yes, yes. Now Steve DeShazer, you know, really started that sort of solution-focused process off. But at the same time, you know, we have the Martin Seligmans going on in the 60s, who was doing the research, pure research on, you know, I guess he was working with dogs at the time, and then he moved to sort of analysing how positive or optimistic people thought and how we might be able to make them shift. So we've got the DeShazer and Insu Kimberg practising this fantastic way of doing therapy, which actually helped people to start seeing where the solutions were in their life, alongside the researchers that are going on. And so I think now we've had them colliding.
And in the grassroots of the counselling sessions, you've seen this work immeasurably well for people.
Wonderfully well, yeah. Wonderfully well. I find I come out of a counselling session often feeling quite invigorated because we've really worked towards that building the solutions approach and really looking at, you know, looking for the exceptions to the rule, and finding how we can optimise really good situations and making them even more so.
Yeah. Okay, if you'd like to join the conversation and put your question to Lynn, any and everything, 1300 40 20 20 is the number. Julie has rung in from Dandenong in Victoria. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Here's Lynn. Fine, thanks. Thanks
for
ringing.
Hi, Lynn.
What would you like to ask Lynn?
Yeah, I was just talking with my friends and looking some information regarding soul ties. Do you know much about that?
Soul ties. Tell me a little bit more.
Soul ties. I'm not sure if you can have emotional soul ties or sexual soul ties in the past, you know, before becoming a Christian. And and it's like, I don't know if they're spirits or demons that you need to break off.
Okay, okay.
Do you know much about that?
I think there's been a lot of work in the area of psychology that looks at attachment and how, particularly with sexual interaction with people, that there's a really deep attachment. There's also some thought that there may be some spiritual dimension with that as well, and certainly in some really you know, difficult situations that people have gone through, particularly with sexual abuse, there have been associated with, you know, not necessarily we could say demon possession, but we could say that it was about someone trying to control a young child or a person through sexuality or using them as pawns and an abuse. So I think there's often what you would call, I wouldn't call it soul ties, and I haven't heard that term before, but I'll go and look it up now.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
But I think that we need to be very aware that oftentimes when this sort of level of abuse has occurred, that there is an unusual type of attachment that occurs, and it's really sad, really hard to break.
It sounds like we're dealing in a realm beyond the existence that we understand. Do you accept the reality of that other world or another world?
In the area of psychology, I think we're beginning in the research, particularly in the area of mind control and particularly with trauma and sexual abuse. There has been a lot of things uncovered that it cannot be explained. Now, psychology likes to research things, and they like to find phenomena and then find more phenomena and research that. And there's been enough evidence to show that there has been, some really difficult situations associated with mind control as associated with your sexual abuse.
And at the end of the day, Christian faith would hold that there is another world, there is another existence beyond this life. Julie, I hope that's helped. Thanks very much for your call. Albert's rung in from Adelaide. Hi, Albert.
Hey, I'm Albert from Adelaide.
Yeah, thanks for ringing. What would you like to ask Lynn? Albert?
Yeah, I'm a motivational speaker and a writer as well. How can you influence someone who is really, really negative about things they do?
So how do you influence somebody who's incredibly negative?
Yeah.
That's a really hard one.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the best things that you can do is not necessarily try and match their negative with a positive, because if you try and match it and their negative with a positive, you'll find that that they would just try and increase their negatives and offset it again.
Or shut down
or have reasons why, you're wrong. What you're better off to do is to be, you can actually be negative and optimistic. Now, that sounds really strange, but something bad could be going wrong, but you can break it down into small steps and work out how that went wrong in the first place. And if you're not blaming yourself, but you're actually attributing why it went wrong to certain circumstances, you're actually being quite optimistic. So that's how I would suggest to work with someone who's very negative.
Can you use a Christian way to influence people? Like, in case the person is really not a Christian,
how can you
do that? Because religion is one of the barriers that you need to break before getting into things like that.
So you're saying if you're a Christian, how do you influence somebody in a positive way? I think probably the best thing you can do is to live your life alongside them, and sometimes not necessarily preaching to them or telling them, but really demonstrating the love of God and showing the optimism that you have in your own life.
It's an interesting answer to that very question. Thank you so much for your call, Albert, to that very question. And you wouldn't say that this is the typical way of answering this, but Dale Stevenson earlier in the program was saying the turning point for him as an avowed atheist was when one of his very good mates who was a Christian said to him, "Dale, are you really going to make your mind up on something that may well hold the key to your destiny based on ignorance?" And it was quite a confronting question. And on the basis of that, he checked it out. And now he's a church minister. So you wouldn't say that you'd do that all the time.
No.
David's rung in from Darwin. Hi, David.
How are you going?
Yep, hi, fine. Dan. Thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, I meet a lot of people who are sort of introverted, pessimist people, and I'm just wondering, are they less resilient than an optimistic extrovert?
Now, that's an interesting question.
Well, coming from an optimistic extrovert on this side of the the radio.
On this side too, I'm an optimistic extrovert myself.
So the
I'll shut up because I'm the introvert.
So the question is that a pessimistic introvert, is that right?
A pessimistic introvert is less resilient than an optimistic extrovert.
What a great question.
I actually think you could be onto something here. Yes, I think that could be quite true. If you're pessimistic and you're introverted, introverted people don't often have the interactions that they need in order to switch from being pessimistic to optimistic.
Yeah.
So they're limited and they don't have as many people, many opportunities really for it to be changed. Whereas the extrovert, they're often out there talking and interacting with people, in which case they get a lot more feedback. But they also get a lot more negative feedback as well because they've stick their necks out.
So what do you do with an introverted pessimist? How do you shake him out of it? I mean, I find it's a hell of a lot of work with them.
I'm sure it is.
But I don't know if shaking them out of it is going to work.
Yeah.
But possibly enabling I guess if you're an extrovert, you're going to have to tone your extroversion down in order to be able to
be with them. Yeah, I always get told to tone it down.
Yes.
I'm too loud, they reckon.
Yes, yes.
See, I can just turn you down here, David. So. I've got
the secret. Watch out, he's got the volume mob on both of us. So what is probably a helpful thing is to actually be really sensitive to a person's introversion and aware that they don't often get the same experience from as many interactions as you would.
Would an initiative where you initiated as the extrovert, bit of fun in the life of an introvert, like true fun,
yes.
Would that help?
I think that would be wonderful to actually have true fun, but not fun that involved, you know, a party of people.
No.
But fun maybe doing
just
something.
One-on-one.
Yeah, one-on-one. Yeah. And really, one of the best things that you can do for someone who is introverted is to do something that involves a fair bit of efficacy. So that's when you actually do something and you get that yes moment and it works. So it might be an adventure sport or doing something that you both at the end of it being able to say, yes, that was fantastic, we did that.
Or some mud racing. I heard from my son in Darwin, David, that they do mud racing up there.
Which, yeah, mud racing season's on now. It's full on. And there's plenty of mud.
Okay, that's
lots
it.
Lots of fun to me.
The introvert pessimist now is doing mud racing.
Good luck.
With you.
When you find, when you find something fun, give us a ring. Let us know.
Okay.
Thanks, David, so much. Good on you.
Bye.
Speaking of resilience, how much is that tied into the whole positive psychology movement? I expect it is
a lot.
Yes.
A lot. One of the key things in resilience is that that having that efficacy. So when you can do something, when you can say, I can do something to change my circumstances, and having a number of those events in your life where you can draw on your can-do attitude. But along with that, you also need to have people around you to help you to cope, or to have people that you can rely on or bounce ideas off. And as well as that, and a sense of identity,
yeah.
Who you are as a person. I have people around to help me to cope, and I am a nice person, and I can do things to change my circumstances. And you get those messages from seven different areas of your life, but you only need to have three happening at a time. And for those people who have three areas of their life where they're linked and they're connected and they're getting message of, I have people to help me to cope, I am a nice person and I can do things to change my circumstances, that's when we're the most resilient.
The genius of the resilience donut, Lynn Worsley. We'll have to call it quits for now, but we've got some more calls. We'll take some questions for next week. If you'd like to come up with your own, and give us a call next week on 1300 40 2020. Lynn Worsley, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Lee.
See you soon.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.